Hello, and welcome to the interview series New Books in African American Studies, where scholars and writers of African American life, culture, arts, and sciences discuss their new books. I'm your host, Vershawn Young, and today I had the privilege of talking to Alan Nadell, the editor of a provocative new collection of essays on playwright August Wilson. The title of his book is August Wilson, Completing the 20th Century Cycle. The focus of this volume is on the second half of August Wilson's 10-play cycle, and it is a companion volume to Alan Nadell's first collection of essays titled May All Your Fences Have Gates, Essays on the Drama of August Wilson. Both of these volumes are published by the University of Iowa Press. Alan Nadell is a prolific writer and scholar, and today he took time out of his busy schedule to discuss how he came to the project on August Wilson and what that research might mean for you and me. Let's listen in. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Vershawn. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Good.
Today we're talking to Alan Nadell about his new book, August Wilson, Completing the 20th Century Cycle, published by the University of Iowa Press in 2010. I've read this book, and I can recommend it highly, especially as a companion to Alan's first edited collection, May All Your Fences Have Gates, August Wilson. Alan, I wonder if you can begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, okay. Right now I'm an endowed chair at the University of Kentucky in American Literature and Culture. I'm what they call the William T. Bryan Chair. I did my undergraduate work at Brooklyn College, and as it turned out, my master's there too, where I wrote a thesis on Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man as a rewrite of Huckleberry Finn from the perspective of Jim, or a symbolic rewrite of it. That became the seed of the dissertation that I wrote at Rutgers University, which really looked at the way Ralph Ellison used the allusions in his text to 19th century American literature in order to create a whole new critical perspective on that. That book was called Invisible Criticism. After that, I got my first job at Purdue University, and it was in post-World War II American fiction was the niche they had me in. And I started working on something called which became a book called Containment Culture, that covered the culture of the Cold War, and it was the first time I started branching out beyond simply literary studies into things like film and drama and historical artifacts and TV commercials and things like that. I've written a book on since then on television in black and white America, and I edited these now two books on Wilson. The way I came to Wilson was kind of interesting. As I was actually working on Containment Culture, I started to notice that in a lot of African American literature, there was a kind of leap to the let's just say call it the supernatural. A number of people have called this magical realism. Toni Morrison has taken that term to describe herself, deriving it from Central American, particularly Colombian writing. I'm less inclined to call it magical realism because it deprives the work, both the Latin American work and the African American work, of its own historical specificity. So I think we might need a second name for it. But anyway, what struck me about that, what was really important to me, was that it seemed to me this leap to the figurative world, the imaginative world, was a reflection of the historical fact that the court decisions, not just leading up to the Civil War, but even after, continued to treat African-American humanity as if it were figurative and property rights as if they were literal, so that black humanity was contingent on the claim to black humanity not impinging on anybody's property rights. So the property rights, most classically in the Great Dred Scott decision, took precedence over the human rights that were in conflict with it. And I was thinking about this a lot, and when I just happened to go to see Fences when it was on Broadway in 1986. And it seemed so powerfully to consolidate all of the issues that I was thinking about at the time that I became very interested in Wilson's work. And then I put together a session for the Modern Language Association to deal with his drama. He had now just sort of exploded on the horizon, had 2 Pulitzer Prizes, and it was becoming clearly one of the most important of American playwrights. And then I called my editor at Iowa, who had recently published the Ralph Ellison book, and I said, would you be interested in a book, a collection of essays on August Wilson? And I think they ran that contract through about as fast as any academic press has ever done that. They just they said yes. At that point, there was nothing. There were no scholarly books on Wilson. Someone named Marilyn Elkins was doing a book at the same time. It turned out a collection for Garland Press, which is reputable, but not an academic press. So this was the first book. In fact, Wilson's niece, Kim Ellis, told me that when she first wanted to learn something about his drama and she asked him to explain it to her, I don't know if she was a teenager or just a young adult, he gave her a copy of this book. He said, this is the introduction to the work. So what happened is, anyway, I put this collection together, and at the time he had completed 5 plays in the cycle, and there were fewer people working in African-American drama at the time. In fact, there were fewer African-American playwrights. Not that there weren't any, but there were fewer who had achieved the same kind of notoriety, and there were very few people working in the field, and finding contributors was hard, and I just worked the phones as if I were an aluminum siding salesman trying to talk smart people I knew into contributing essays and working with them so we get some interesting areas covered, and that collection came out and continues to do pretty well, I gather. Well, that was the first 5 plays, and now we move more than a decade later, and the cycle is moving into completion. We're almost, I think that book came out in 93, so 2003, Wilson's working on the last of his plays by then. And it occurred to me that we needed something on that, so I decided to throw a conference in Kentucky. When I moved to the University of Kentucky in 2006, I decided to throw a conference just devoted to the final 5 plays, which get less critical attention, not just because they're newer, but because some of the earlier plays like Fences and The Piano Lesson and Ma Rainey have been very canonized and are performed much more frequently. So I said, okay, let's look at the last 5, but let's look at them as part of a whole cycle. And I invited all of the major August Wilson scholars that I knew, and we're kind of a small club to come here. And Harry Elam, who probably now has the best single monograph on Wilson, The Past is Present, terrific book on Wilson's drama, who taught at Stanford, actually had a conference that same weekend at Stanford on race and narrative that had been organized by his wife, and he took a night flight out of Palo Alto or San Jose, actually, I think, to get here for the Saturday of the conference. He'd been up all night, which was really, I thought, terrific. And again, I contacted Iowa and said, would you want to do a second edition of the first book, and I'll remove some of the essays and I'll add some of the essays from this conference. And they said, we'll get back to you. And they said, well, your first book's still doing pretty well. I said, well, you could have fooled me from the royalties. I didn't look that way to me, but if you say so, that's why. They said, so we'd like to just do a second book as a companion piece, and that's exactly what they did. And for the cover of the first book, we got permission to use the Romare Bearden collage called The Piano Lesson, which was the inspiration for Wilson's play, The Piano Lesson. So for the second book, we got permission to use another Bearden collage, The Millhand's Lunch Bucket, which was the inspiration for Joe Turner's Coming on. Even though that's one of the plays from the first 5, it still seemed like a very nice way to unite the two collections, and they used a kind of similar design. So that's how I came to this thing, and it's starting to get reviews, and as things go, it's been getting very, very good reviews. I think again, because just as the first collection was the first real scholarly exploration of his plays, the second collection is the first scholarly exploration of the cycle as such, at least as in terms of a collection of essays. Harry Elam certainly covers all 10 plays in his book.
Okay. Let me ask you this question. Before we start talking specifically about the new book, I want to just go back to something that you said earlier about magical realism, for instance.
Sure.
And I want you to do two things, if you will. Can you say what the alternative term is, or the alternative perspective is? You said you did really that you sort of don't use the term magical realism. And then I want you to say specifically where in Wilson's plays do you see such a concept portrayed or represented?
Okay. Yeah, well, let's start with, I don't think there is an alternative term because no one's bothered to coin it. Toni Morrison calls herself a magical realist. And, you know, I guess she has a right to call herself anything she wants. Terms aren't, you know, natural things. This is not a biological thing where we're looking at DNA of a play. It's just a loose way of referring to things to give us a shorthand so that we don't have to start describing every play from scratch when we can group. We say, well, this is romantic poetry. We have a rough sense of what that means, even if the major romantic poets weren't exactly like one another at all. So the same thing, you know, it's a useful term. The reason I wish someone would promote a new term that isn't called magical realism is that I'm a very strong believer in the historical specificity of everything. I think things may have what people call universal appeal, but that doesn't mean that they aren't universal appeal as historical representations of their moment. Shakespeare was an Elizabethan and early Jacobean playwright, as well as someone that we can read in millions of languages and times and cultures. And I think it's really important to remember that these two things are always intention. So the term magical realism arises out of a whole set of political and historical circumstances specific to Latin American post-colonialism. It has to do with a kind of unreal sensibility of being in a strange place where the dominant language is not the indigenous language, and the indigenous people are incorporated into a certain kind of political configuration that is somewhat, you know, surreal. And I'm using this not in the technical sense of French surrealism, but in, you know, a general sense of dreamlike or not quite real. And this style was a response to the political conditions that informed Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Colombia, and was very attractive to a number of other Latin American writers that were in a similar situation. African Americans do not exist in the same relationship to power that Colombian people do. The Colombian people are both the colonizer and the post-colonialized people. They're much more analogous in certain ways, at least, to the founding fathers of the United States as much as to the colonized people. They were colonies, but they were also colonies of the colonizers, as the United States was. African Americans, you know, will come as no shock to you, came to the United States under radically different circumstances. They did not come to colonize the tobacco fields of Virginia. I mean, that's not what happened. And the historical circumstances that surrounded their assimilation, in whatever sense we want to configure that assimilation, their incorporation into American history and culture, is much more complex, and it's just different. It's not that it's better or worse, it's just different. And therefore, we might look at some of the same effects, like these kinds of moments where we move into a transcendent or surreal or dreamlike or a supernatural space that supplants the normative reality of a kind of naturalism. We might look at that as being similar to something that happens in Marquez's novels, just as we might look at things like that in Toni Morrison or any of a number of other African-American writers. We might look at that as being similar in style, but the meaning is different because the historical situation that informs it is different. And that's why I wish someone would pick another term and say, yes, it's like magical realism. However, it's not. But you know, maybe this is equivalent, maybe it isn't. In any case, in Wilson, for example, and this is the moment, the first moment that just struck me is I'm watching Fences, and it looks very much like a kind of naturalist play. And, you know, many people have drawn comparisons between it and Death of a Salesman. You know, in a loose, vague sense, I would say that's correct. But in a more specific sense, I'd say it's a kind of red herring. But in any case, it's, kind of in this naturalist tradition. And then at the end of the play, Gabriel, Troy Maxson's brother, who has been brain damaged from World War II injuries, and goes through the play as a kind of, well, a combination of lunatic or Shakespearean fool or a deluded person who believes himself in certain ways to be Gabriel, going around with his trumpet that has no mouthpiece. He decides at Troy's funeral to play music so that Troy can be play his trumpet so that Troy can be admitted to heaven. And the trumpet, of course, doesn't function very well without a mouthpiece, Gabriel is at first confronted with his own illusions. And since this is a tragedy, it's a very sad play in many ways, and like most tragedies, in certain ways, triumphant. It's one watching it for the first time, not having read it, just seeing it, wonders, oh my God, this will be like the final moment where we have to face our illusions and understand that we are, you know, time bound people, and that Troy's battles with death, and he has dialogues with death, and all of these things are, simply in his imagination. And then Gabriel instead does a dance, and all of a sudden, it says in the play, when I later read it, the gates of heaven open wide. And on stage, it looks that. It looks like this is really what's happened. Not that it's going on in Gabriel's mind or in our mind, but literally, Gabriel has opened the gates of heaven, that he is not the deluded ones, but that we have been misperceiving him, and that we move into some sort of supernatural space. Similarly, at the end of Joe Turner, we see things like this. There are all kinds of, at the beginning of Seven Guitars, there's a whole discussion of whether it starts after the funeral of Floyd Barton, the central character. People are talking about seeing spirits carry him away. And then there's the figure of Aunt Esther, who is a kind of magical presence, who's supposed to be as old as slavery in America. She's over 300 years old, depending on which play, how much older. And people go to see her, and then kinds of strange, miraculous things happen. In the play where we actually see her live on the stage, Gem of the Ocean, the next to the last play that Wilson wrote, she actually takes Citizen Barlow on a trip through back to the cities of bones beneath the ocean, which is the graveyard of all the people who died in the Middle Passage of the slave ships. And again, we could say this is just a metaphor, and it certainly has a kind of metaphoric or figurative import. But I think in the terms of the play, we have to take that as the play's reality, that is the naturalism of the play, that this figurative world has the power of transcendence that the literal world has historically denied African Americans in a number of different ways, including an array of legal decisions and social practices.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for that. Now let's talk about the book in particular. I noticed right off that the title of the new collection, August Wilson Completing the 20th Century Cycle, is much more straightforward than the title of the first book, May All Your Fences Have Gates.
Gates, yeah. Yeah.
What went into the decision on the title?
Well, you know, the first title is obviously a much better one. The first title comes from this. When I knew Wilson, and I met him a number of times, and I asked him to, I think the first time I met, I asked him to autograph a hardback collection of three plays that I had. And what he wrote as the thing is, you know, to Alan Nadell, May All Your Fences Have Gates. And in the introduction to my first volume, I sort of explain that this is that the theater, the proscenium arch, is a gateway to the worlds that we don't have direct access to in our everyday lives, but that's what theater does. And at the end of that introduction, it's typically not the introduction, actually the preface. Typically in prefaces, one starts with some explanation of why or how you're doing this, and ends thanking the people who helped you, your family, you know, your dog, whatever, whoever gets thanked in this, and your editor. Sometimes those are interchangeable, but in any case, you get down to this. Thank you, and I finally thanked Wilson. And I said, you know, may all your gates open both ways. So basically, it seemed to me to encapsulate the theme of the book. And it's, you know, so it's may all your fences have gates. Essays on the drama of August Wilson. I think, just from a kind of street smarts, that it's easier to get reviewed and found and it show up on Amazon when people do searches if the subject is the front. So it was a purely tactical thing. I don't think this title is nearly as interesting, but it's kind of much more useful for librarians and book reviewers and people searching Amazon to find it. And I thought that I ought to put that interest ahead of having a kind of apt but poetic title.
Nice. Speaking of reviews, what are the reviews saying about this new book?
Well, they're mostly so far brief reviews. I haven't seen anything at any great length, although I gather there's one forthcoming in contemporary literature, which tends to have longer reviews. They're all very favorable. You know, choice, highly recommended, all of this. Basically, it stresses that it asks us to look at the collection as a whole cycle and see Wilson's themes that aren't just located in one play. And it praises the thing for giving us more than one essay on the same topic so that we can look at different characters like Aunt Esther or violence or property rights from different perspectives, and it helps us facilitate the kind of interpretive enterprise that's, you know, good, and that it's also all very clear and accessible, and general readers could read it as easily as academics. So that's nice. That's what you want to get. No, I'm not complaining.
I noticed that there are at least a couple, if not several, authors in this book that were in the first collection. Harry Elam, Sandra Shannon are two. And I presume that the writers were very, very interested in contributing to this work.
Well, yeah, that's actually those two were people around whom I'd structure things. Basically, as I said, Sandra has been at the center of Wilson criticism from very early on. And the essay that she had in the first collection, she had just completed a PhD in Wilson, and she was doing an annotated bibliography of him and doing some other work, which eventually became a critical biography of his first plays that were published by Howard University Press. And this was one of her first essays. She contacted me when I sent out the call for papers. And similarly, Harry Elam was untenured, had just moved to Stanford, sent me an idea for an essay. I wrote back to him and said, this sounds like good thing, but here are some of the suggestions I have. This is pre-email, so we then had a phone conversation, a handwritten note followed by a phone conversation, things that don't exist anymore. we were really, you know, at a certain point in our careers, all getting started on Wilson. So when I envisioned the conference here, I made them the core of the conference. They were the plenary speakers along with Don Pease and Steve Tracy and myself. And we were the core. And when I originally proposed to Iowa that we would take these plenary talks and put them in the old thing, and I would kick out some other essays or tighten them up and make a little room. And once we they said, well, to do a second book, I not only had that scaffold of the core contributors, the major Wilson scholars, and we are. I would say that Harry, Sandra, and I are certainly among the if not the three most prominent Wilson scholars, certainly among the three of the most six most prominent Wilson scholars, roughly. That became the scaffold, and I invited some other very strong people like Donald Pease and Steve Tracy to be plenary speakers as well. And then I opened up, I told everyone in the conference that I would consider their papers for publication, and a number of them submitted versions of the papers. And in one case, there were two that had enough overlap that I actually wrote back to them and said, I'd like to use this, but is it all right with you if I rewrite it to combine the two, with their approval, of course, with their approval of the final product, because I could thereby take both of their ideas and squeeze it into one essay because I had so many good and interesting responses. So it's not accidental. We are the major Wilson scholars, but then there's a whole bunch of other people, including some people at the conference who had been Harry's students at Stanford. We were looking at people who were the people that are becoming a next generation of Wilson scholars who are studying with people like us. Nathan Grant, who also contributed went on during that period, actually, just right after the conference, to become the editor of African American Review. And Herman Beavers is at University of Pennsylvania. He, too, was at the conference in Palo Alto at Stanford and took the same night flight with Harry to get here, which is quite a compliment. I think we're getting a kind of core of people that would give us the rough parameters of what you'd call Wilson studies. Sandra right now is editing an MLA Approaches to Teaching Wilson volume, and I'm in that. I don't know if Harry is. He might be. Yeah, he is.
What do you like most about this book?
About the book?
Yeah.
Well, I think I pretty much, I agree with the reviewers. I like the fact that it reads from beginning to end. There's nobody who is smart but obscure, I'm very much a hands-on editor, so I try to get everything into a kind of constant, consistent tone. But having said that, I think it's anybody can read it, and I think it just starts raising a bunch of questions that are smart. I think there are still more questions to be raised. I certainly am sure I could, or someone could, do another collection on the essays on Wilson and look at a whole bunch of other themes that we didn't touch on. But I think it's got a kind of rich examination of the themes that unite those last five plays and how that informs the whole cycle.
I completely agree with that. We've given the listeners a nice overview of the book, discussing it. Would you mind reading a couple passages?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. I'd be happy to. So let me, I think since it's a collection of essays, I'm going to read some passages from the introduction and maybe one other thing, because otherwise I'd be just sort of jumping around. And basically at the beginning, I start the introduction with an anecdote about Wilson's first Broadway production, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which was workshopped at the O'Neill Theater, and which is a contest. He won the contest. He'd been trying to write plays. He had a few plays in some form in the drawer. Ma Rainey finally gets him there. They workshop it, and he's offered a contract to go to Broadway with us. And he is, he's around 40 years old, and he has not much of an income, and it's a very lucrative contract, but he loses all artistic control over the play. it's very ironic because Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is about property rights and artistic control over the recording of a recording made by the blues singer Ma Rainey. So let me read it here from the beginning. It says, conflict over the meaning of property, implicit, arguably, in all of Wilson's drama, becomes particularly cogent in the last two plays that Wilson completed, Gem of the Ocean and Radio Golf. These plays culminate the writing of Wilson's 10-play 20th Century Cycle and set in 1904 and 1997, respectively. They also bookend the time span that the cycle chronicles. In Gem, a black man has died in order to prove that his life is worth more than a bucket of nails. And in Radio Golf, another black man abandons his mayoral aspirations to affirm the property rights of a Pittsburgh home once owned by his great aunt that legitimately belongs to his cousin. In Ma Rainey, in other words, even before Wilson had fully envisioned the cycle that would trace the arc of black ownership in the 20th century, he grappled with some of its basic issues. These entail the relationship of human worth to human labor, to human production, to physical property, as all of these factors are weighed on the imbalanced scale of America's racial history. Clearly, the Broadway producers who wanted to acquire Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, who wanted to put their own property rights above those of Wilson, didn't understand the property they were pursuing. When Wilson raised objections, he was told that the contract wasn't that important. In this industry, they said, we go a lot on faith. As long as the words don't mean anything, Wilson responded, why don't you write the contract my way? And this led to his not signing the contract and taking it to Lloyd Richards, who did it at the Yale Rep, and then they eventually brought it to Broadway under the strict control. Now, just to read a little more, jumping down here, and as he says, basically, the other five plays completing the cycle, in order of the New York production, Seven Guitar, Jitney, King Henry II, Gem of the Ocean, and Radio Golf, not only give the cycle some new dimensions, but also provide an overall shape that converts the cycle from an anthology to a loosely structured epic. Mm-hmm. Several factors affect that shift. The first is the revised Jitney, converted from a solitary play written in the historical present of the 1970s to the play Wilson used to represent the 1970s decade in the 10-play project that Wilson conceived after Jitney, was first written and performed regionally. As the play reunites the cycle with a history of its own origins, therefore, it multiplies the historical dimensions of the cycle as a whole. In that play, we see many of the Wilson archetypes: the ambitious young man, the rebellious warrior, the wheeler dealer, the responsible entrepreneur, the oral historian, the crotchety old man, struggling with their personal demons in a world of economic naturalism. So these are this is sort of the way I sort of set up the whole volume here. The introduction, of course, surveys a lot of the other points there, but basically that there's a kind of Wilson world of archetypes that he conceives before he knows he's writing a 10-play cycle. He didn't intend to do that. One thing that was extremely important to Wilson was that he not be a one-play playwright, that he not let success go to his head, that he not think in terms of larger ambitions. He always had larger ambitions, that he would never, never complete anything until he already knew what the first line of the next thing he was going to do was.
Wow.
It was just absolutely, and by the time he died, I think there was more than one thing that he had on that back burner, but it was absolutely important to him that, you know, you put down something, you start the next thing. So he had these various plays, and he had certain ideas about what he wanted to do. And someplace along the way, he realized that he had set some plays in different decades, and this gave him the structure for his work, so he could see this 10-play cycle emerging, and he starts to then think, okay, I'll do the next play in this decade, I'll do the next play in this decade, I'll do this, I'll do that. Some of them were, as I say, things he already had in the drawer that he had worked on, and then he has decades to start filling in. At a certain point in this process, he goes back to the play written in 1978 and performed regionally in 1978, and rewrites it as the 70s decade play in the 10-play cycle. So in an odd way, Jitney, even though it's in the second five plays, it's late in the cycle, it's his earliest play. And we can see there that even before he's thinking about this larger historical trajectory, he's thinking about the kinds of people who are fashioned within that world in the black community, and he's starting to see certain types of people, and then helping us see how historical circumstances and specific circumstances bring out different aspects of their character or their behavior. Mm-hmm. So that is very important. And again, always important in his plays is the notion of property. And the way that this, you might say this intersects is when you talk about property, the word property can mean something you own. You know, this is my land or my car. But it also could mean this is my characteristic, the properties of something, mm-hmm. the traits. Mm-hmm. And so basically the properties, the archetypal properties or characteristics of the people he meets are intersect always with the property rights, the properties, the things they own or want to acquire or the way they are owned or acquired. And I think this notion of property then splits both ways and helps structure the parameters of his enterprise.
Interesting. The book covers a lot of ground. The author's essays that you've collected deal variously with issues of gender, manhood, womanhood, economic capitalism, as you've mentioned, religion, even politics in the age of Obama. What direction do you think Wilson's scholarship should go or is going now?
Well, I don't know. You know, as we speak, there are people. One of the things about academic publishing particularly is after somebody has put the last dot on the last I of their essay, and if anybody else out there knows about it, you're talking about almost a two-year span.
Right.
It used to be more than 2 years. Now that we can do online searches, we cut that bibliography time down. It used to be the Modern Language Association came out with the bibliography once a year, and you had to wait for it to be published, which was a year after the year it was published. So you were 2 years out. There are people doing all kinds of things right now. There's a guy named David Karasner who is doing, I believe, an authorized biography. I have never met him. I had invited him to come to the conference, but he wasn't able to.
He's an African American theater historian, right?
Yeah. Well, he was a junior faculty at Yale, and he moved to I think Emerson College. I don't know if he's an assistant or associate professor there now. I don't know, and I'm not sure quite how he fell into the loop of getting the authorized biography. His estate is controlled by Wilson's estate is controlled by Constanza Romero, who was his wife. She's a set and a costume designer, and she did the work on the Piano Lesson, which is how he met her. And she's just started working again, the revival of Fences. She was up there on stage when it got the Tony for the best revival, and she had done the costumes for that. So she is in charge of deciding who gets access and who doesn't, and I have stayed. I gather there's a lot of infighting there. I don't know much about it, and the less I know, the happier I am.
Yeah, sure.
I knew Costanza. I don't know her well. We had very cordial relations when I knew her. I have no idea what's going on, but there's a Wilson Center in Pittsburgh where people are doing a whole bunch of things, including his family, very involved in that, and there's Costanza living in Seattle, which is where they she has control of unpublished things and the estate and productions, and I think, as I said, the less I know about it, the happier I am. I'm happier with now. In terms of, I mean, I think there are lots of directions you could go, and that's what's great about literary criticism. You know, there was a time when I was young, which was like, you know, sometime before the flood, and at that point there were people who actually believed, oh, I found out the meaning of Moby Dick, and I better publish it before someone else finds out the meaning of Moby Dick, as if there was this thing and it was a puzzle and the person who unpacked it first, you know, got the gold ring. I think we now know, and I think this is not I'm not letting any secrets out, that literary criticism is structured not by the a meaning that is hidden in a book, but by the questions we ask.
Yes.
You know, you get answers to the question. So there's a lot of questions about performativity and identity. There's a lot of questions about literacy. There's a lot of questions yet to be asked about gender and power. I just finished a Wilson seminar, and one of my students did a paper on mothers and motherhood in Wilson. Now, there are many more men than women in his plays, and there have been some criticism of his depiction of women, but there's also been a lot of noting that the women he does have are often very strong and independent, and even if the men say, I need you to complete me, they're not actually buying that necessarily. And there's a lot to be done, I think, about motherhood. You have the great mother figure of Aunt Esther, but there's not nearly as much to be done about understanding motherhood in the place where there are people whose role as mother is the patriarchal feuds and are much more important. In fact, if you've got a minute, I want to read another section of my introduction, which deals with Don Pease's really interesting essay on the King Headley cycle and what Don calls the Lazarus complex. The point, what happens is in one of the plays, one of the characters is very down on Jesus for resurrecting Lazarus, because what he points out is that Jesus wasn't doing Lazarus any favor, because Lazarus is just going to die again, and enabled him to die twice. Most of us only have to do that once, you know. And if I recall the line correctly, the character Stool Pigeon, he changes names. I can't remember if he says it as Stool Pigeon or as Cain will. But in either case, what he says is when Lazarus was dying the second time, maybe of pneumonia, he sees Jesus come. He says, "Oh, not you again." So what Don does from this is to develop a concept of a Lazarus complex. I want to read you a little bit, because this is another structuring thing in a lot of the plays. And again, this is my introductory summary of Don's. The Lazarus complex, as Don Pease so brilliantly named and explained it, is Wilson's unique understanding of the unrepresentable void that separates a spiritual violence doomed to its own reproduction from the blues that such violence produces. By pointing out that the resurrection of Lazarus is not a miracle of reward, but a miraculous punishment, Wilson relegates the story of Lazarus, Pease makes clear, to the realm of vengeance, the act of forcing Lazarus to relive his death. That vengeance replicates itself when men are forced to reenact the killing of their fathers in retribution for the cycle of violence from which their fathers found no escape. A cycle initiated by the involuntary capture, transatlantic transportation, and New World servitude of Africans, all of which began at the moment of Aunt Esther's birth. Pease's insight places King Headley II in a focal relationship to the entire Wilson cycle, providing the moment when Wilson can release his own cycle from the same complex that has entrapped his characters. The very first murder in the history of the cycle's composition, Booster's killing of the white woman who lied about him in Jitney, effects the actual death of Booster's mother and the spiritual death of his relationship with his father. And so it goes through the generations of Wilson's plays, as it did through the centuries that compiled the Middle Passage's Sunken City of Bones, and through the centuries in which which people crossed the ocean under which that city was buried. Troy Maxson, Boy Charles, Crawley, and the Ghosts of the Yellow Dog walk in the shadow of Lazarus, not to mention both King Headley's Floyd Barton and that other nominal king, Leroy Slater. Only after King's refusal in King Headley II to participate in the cycle of retributive violence can Wilson's plays move past his own drama's restaging of that complex. King Headley II ends, therefore, not with the death of King, but with the rebirth of Aunt Esther, as signified by her cat's meowing, and, more important, as demonstrated by her informing presence in Wilson's final two plays, her flesh as represented in Gem of the Ocean, and in Radio Golf, her spirit. In both plays, she is thus the anti-Lazarus, the presence, as Pease makes clear, embodied instead by and in the blues community.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a really wonderful insight about Wilson as a a biographical author. That is, once he finds in King Hedley II a way of escaping this cycle of retributive violence, the origins of which, of course, are slavery, but that are not, but find no adequate venting against the people who perpetrated that, that violence, and instead end up being restaged within the community over and over again. Once Wilson finds a way out of to allow his characters to turn that down, he himself writes plays that, in, at least in that regard, are very different. And Gem of the Ocean, set in 1903, and Radio Goth, 1907, are actually part A and B, in that they have the same characters. They the people at the end of the century are the grandchildren of the people at the beginning of the century. So it is another way of understanding the generational issues. And it's not that they don't exist, but that they exist not in the tremendously tragic cycle of attributive violence.
Wow, very captivating stuff, Alan. So thinking about the readership of the book, I've read the book as a, of course, as a scholar, as a teacher, as a general reader. I think it's going to be very useful in the classroom. I haven't taught it yet. I've taught the first book, May All Your Fences Have Gates. What would you like those various readers to take away from the book?
Well, I you know, the first thing, obviously, is this is the monumental American playwright. It's always silly to have ratings, who's number one, who's number two. But there's no question that Wilson is in the same category as someone like Eugene O'Neill or Arthur Miller, Edward Albee. I think it's hard to miss that. I would argue there's no playwright in American history that has 10 plays of this quality. Perhaps there's no play written in America as good as Long Day's Journey Into Night. But there's a lot of other Eugene O'Neill that you really have to have a couple of drinks before you reread them. You know, I mean, it's really, you know, and again, he's a great playwright. I don't mean to suggest it, but it's a canon that many parts of which are very dated or problematic. And Tennessee Williams similarly has, you know, an incredible body of four or five major plays. And it was very prolific. They continue to have posthumous stuff there. But again, it's uneven. But again, I don't want to say Wilson's better than Williams or Williams better. These are comparable playwrights. The first thing you have to come away with is that Wilson is one of the major American playwrights, black, white, or anything. This is not an African-American niche playwright, although it's certainly an African-American playwright. So that's the first thing. The next thing I want to come away with is the difference between looking at a bunch of plays that delve the same theme. And there's nothing wrong with that. Eugene O'Neill does that. Arthur Miller did it. That's fine. But this is also a coherent opus, and there's nothing like it in American drama, and there's precious little like it in world drama. So I'd like to come away with that. And finally, I can come away with the idea that there are lots of different ways to look at things, that interpretation isn't finding the right answer, but you know, seeing something that is rich enough to produce lots of ways of thinking about it.
Nice. Well, Alan, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I have one last question for you, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, there's actually three things that I could highlight right now. The first is a book that I co-edited with Susan Griffin that is literally going into press as we speak, or has just gone into press, should be out next November, and that's on Alfred Hitchcock and Henry James. And we got a wonderful collection of essays just where we just asked authors to pick one film by Hitchcock and one work by James and put them together and make of it what they will, and then we push them to look not just at the specific similarities or interesting connections, but the larger implications for cinema or narrative or character. And so that's it. I've been working slowly because other projects keep coming up on a book called Unintelligent Design, or How Bush Knew, which is an attempt to look at the various things that passed for intelligence in the Bush administration. And I think passed would be in the sense not of, of racial passing, but more like kidney stones. And so it looks at things like airport security and Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ and its role in the Bush reelection campaign, and the fact that we had no occupation, literally had no occupation plan for Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. So that's coming along, and it continues. I continue right now. I give lectures from it in Losi. And I guess the third thing is that I just finished teaching a Wilson seminar here, and I've been, you know, I know the canon now, you know, pretty well, and in the course of thinking about the plays as I went through them week by week with the students, I realized there's still a lot that I have to say about individual plays that probably hasn't been published, and I've also published some essays, next spring, I'm going to be teaching a Wilson seminar in Italy on a Fulbright. And I think if I just write, in the European tradition, the students, you know, are not encouraged to talk. I've been told they you show up, you lecture, they attend. So I'm thinking if I really just write out the lectures, that I might come back next year with a monograph on Wilson, giving some more takes on this whole thing that are really the product of these seminars. And, so those would be the three things that are on the front burner.
Very nice. Alan, all of those sounds like great projects. And I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Wow.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. This has really been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, right. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Alan Adell speak about his new book, August Wilson, Completing the 20th Century Cycle. It's quite obvious that Alan is very enthusiastic about the subject of August Wilson's plays, and I hope our conversation encourages you to read the book. Thank you for listening.